This is JS Party, your weekly celebration of JavaScript and the web. Check us out on the web at jsparty.fm. There you'll find our recommended episodes, listener favorites, and a request form so you can let us know what you want to hear about on the pod.
That's a great idea. I'm glad I had it.
Thanks to our partners for helping us bring you world-class developer pods each and every week. Fassy.com, Fly.io, and TypeSense.org. Okay, hey, it's party time, y'all.
What's up, friends? I'm here with one of our good friends, Firas Abukadije. Firas is the founder and CEO of Socket. You can find them at socket.dev. Secure your supply chain, ship with confidence. But Firas, I have a question for you. What's the problem? What security concerns do developers face when consuming open source dependencies? What does Socket do to solve these problems?
So the problem that Socket solves is when a developer is choosing a package, there's so much potential information they could look at, right? I mean, at the end of the day, they're trying to get a job done, right? There's a feature they want to implement. They want to solve a problem. So they go and find a package that looks like it might be a promising solution. Maybe they check to see that it has an open source license, that it has good docs. Maybe they check the number of downloads or GitHub stars. But most developers don't really go beyond that. And if you think about what it means to use a good package, to find it, to use a good open source dependency, we care about a lot of other things too, right? We care about who is the maintainer? Is this thing well maintained? From a security perspective, we care about, does this thing have known vulnerabilities? Does it do weird things? Maybe it takes your environment variables and it sends them off to the network, meaning it's going to take your API keys, your tokens. Like, that would be bad. The unfortunate thing is that today, most developers who are choosing packages and going about their day, they're not looking for that type of stuff. It's not really reasonable to expect a developer to go and open up every single one of their dependencies and read every line of code. Not to mention that the average NPM package has 79 additional dependencies that it brings in. So you're talking about just, you know, thousands and thousands of lines of code. And so we do that work for the developer. So we go out and we fully analyze every piece of their dependencies, you know, every one of those lines of code, and we look for strange things. We look for those risks that they're not going to have time to look for. So we'll find, you know, we detect all kinds of attacks and kinds of malware and vulnerabilities in those dependencies, and we bring them to the developer and help them when they're at that moment of choosing a package.
Okay, that's good. So what's the install process? What's the getting started?
Socket's super easy to get started with. So our whole team is made up of developers, and so it's super developer friendly. We got tired of using security tools that send a ton of alerts and were hard to configure and just kind of noisy. And so we built Socket to fix all those problems. So we have all the typical integrations you'd expect, a CLI, a GitHub app, an API, all that good stuff. But most of our users use Socket through the GitHub app, and it's a really fast install. A couple clicks, you get it going, and it monitors all your pull requests. And you can get an accurate and kind of in-depth analysis of all your dependencies. Really high signal to noise. You know, it doesn't just cover vulnerabilities. It's actually about the full picture of dependency risk and quality, right? So we help you make better decisions about dependencies that you're using directly in the pull request workflow, directly where you're spending your time as a developer. You know, whether you're managing a small project or a large application with thousands of dependencies, Socket has you covered, and it's pretty simple to use. It's really not a complicated tool.
Very cool. The next step is to go to socket.dev, install the GitHub app, or book a demo. Either works for us. Again, socket.dev. That's socket.dev.
Hello, everybody. This is so exciting. It's the last show that we are, well, it's not the last show we're recording this year, but it's the last show we're releasing this year. So this is like, it just feels like we're ending this year on such a good note with such an incredible guest and a more incredible topic. The topic that's in the name of the show, we're going to be talking about all the things that are new with JavaScript, and we'll introduce our guests in just a minute. I want to first welcome Nick, one of my co-hosts for the day. How are you, Nick?
Ahoy, hoy, ML. How's it going?
It's going well. I had a bit of a morning today, a little bit of a a scare. A friend of mine was driving in the snow and lost control of their car and kind of was helping with the aftermath of that whole situation. So just a reminder, don't take anything for granted, everyone. Life is short, you know? So yeah, anyways. So Chris, welcome to you as well.
Hi, thanks for welcoming me.
Yeah, you're welcomed to be welcomed. Our special guest for today is none other than Daniel Ehrenberg, also affectionately known on the internet as Little Dan. Welcome, Dan. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me here.
Yay.
Yeah, we're thrilled. We're so thrilled. So for folks who might not be familiar with Dan, he's works at Bloomberg, but I think for me, what resonates when I hear Little Dan is like, I pretty much associate him one-to-one with ECMAScript and standards work. He's been really, really involved with the TC39 and has helped push forward a lot of really incredible specs in JavaScript, both as a champion, as an author, and also just a community liaison. I think he does a lot of really great communication to the community about new specs as well. So Dan, I don't want to butcher your intro, so please, why don't you tell our audience a little bit about yourself?
Oh, that was a great intro. So yeah, I'm Daniel Ehrenberg, Little Dan. I got involved in JavaScript when I was working at Google, and I did an internal transfer to the V8 team.
Ooh.
Where I got to implement some of ES6, including some features that were about arrays, maybe some that were not as good, like simple species, and helped out with async await. And then I jumped ship to a company called Egalia, which is a consultancy that was also working on this project of implementing ES6 and beyond. So we worked on things like BigInt, private fields and methods in JavaScript, and now I'm working at Bloomberg. Bloomberg was sponsoring much of my work that I was doing at Egalia, and I'm working on further proposals that I'm excited to talk about later today, as well as improving the way that we use JavaScript in our internal systems.
Ooh,
frameworks.
Whoa.
We have 8,000 plus engineers here at Bloomberg, and all UI development is done with JavaScript, TypeScript, basically. So we have our own ways of doing it that have been working out well, but can always be more.
Yeah, that's really great. That sounds amazing. I also just generally love Bloomberg and Bloomberg engineers. They're some of my favorite people in the community. And you work on a really cool project, you know, the terminal and like the engineering behind that is just mind blowing. And I hope one day that we will be able to do a show on that in the future. But today we're here to talk about JavaScript.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that would be cool, right? It is a very cool engineering like feat. Like, what is the terminal? It's like four instances of WebKit wrapped around with a bunch of other custom C++ and JavaScript. It's crazy.
Yeah, my coworker Rob Palmer and I have been talking about making a blog post about all this, and it's just a lot of work that we haven't done yet.
Well, Rob Palmer has been invited. He has had an open invitation to this show, and I know you're listening, Rob. So I just want to say, let's talk about the Bloomberg terminal on JS Party, okay? But today again, we're going back to JavaScript, right? So there would be no Bloomberg terminal without JavaScript, right, Dan? Is that fair to say?
At this point, no. I mean, you know,
in the 90s,
the Bloomberg terminal didn't use JavaScript, but it's been a pretty core element since the early 2000s.
Wow, that's amazing. And I can see how that was the case. So getting back to JavaScript, what I'm excited to dig into today, folks, is, you know, just, I, you know, that we have many new listeners. Some of you are very familiar with the standards process and how JavaScript gets made. Some of you are not. So I kind of want to do a little bit of baselining for everyone. You know, what is the TC39? What is ECMAScript? This ECMAScript thing that we keep mentioning and talking about interchangeably with JavaScript. And then we'll talk about the staging process. So what are the kind of steps and milestones that a proposal has to go through in order for it to actually make it into a JavaScript engine and be shipped in the wild? After that, I hope to get into all the fun new specs that have landed recently, as well as some things that are interesting in stage 2 and 3 and 1. And lastly, we'll hopefully talk a bit broadly about open source sustainability. So we have a very packed show today. Dan, are you ready? Did you bring like your dancing shoes or, you know, the equivalent of that?
I'm wearing some shoes that I got from Walmart after one time I was in a kayak and it tipped over and my shoes were kind of destroyed. So I got some $20 shoes from Walmart.
Nice.
Bring to the fancy office.
Nice. All right, so let's start with the TC39. What is it?
Yeah.
And yeah.
So you might have heard of ECMAScript as like a synonym for JavaScript. That's partly because JavaScript is like a trademark that Oracle kind of has some intellectual property related to because of Java, and also to recognize the fact that JavaScript is standardized in ECMA. ECMA used to stand for the European Computer Manufacturing Association. Now it's like KFC. It doesn't stand for anything. It's not even fried anymore. And yeah, I'm actually currently vice president of ECMA. That doesn't mean very much. I'm like vice president of the board. So I'm helping bring in new projects like Cyclone DX is now being standardized in ECMA and trying to bring in Winter CG, which we can talk about later. So within ECMA, TC39 was the 39th technical committee to be created. That's the name. And it's about standardizing JavaScript. So, you know, years ago, before I got involved in this process, I kind of thought, oh, it would be really cool to work on JavaScript, but it just seems like these things are already kind of fixed, or it would be very impossible to change. You would have to be in some, I don't even know what kind of powerful position to do it. But instead, we aim to have this open process where anyone can join the committee, people can participate from outside the committee and make contributions to the language and propose changes and work together with the open source community on developing those changes. So because it's, you know, in the old day, we would have like a waterfall model. We would say, okay, here's the goals for ES6. Let's work on them for 5 years and then publish ES6. After ES6, we decided, no, this is too much. We have to go more incrementally, more, you know, just like with developing software. It used to be of Windows 95, Windows 98, and now we're on these sort of rolling releases. So instead, we developed the proposals through this four-stage process, actually five-stage now. So at stage one, we have an idea that we're all discussing. That means that someone has brought it to committee, it's on the table, and we haven't yet agreed whether we should do anything about it. At stage two, there's a concrete first draft. So there's a concrete specification showing what the language feature would do. And the committee kind of agrees that it should move forward. We kind of hope that it can eventually be part of JavaScript collectively. At stage 2.7, this is the new stage, we've basically finished with the design as much as we can do kind of in theory based on community outreach and based on thinking things through carefully as a committee.
And discussions with implementers too, right? Because the folks that are like working on this stuff, you know, for various browsers are also part of TC39 and they weigh in on implementation. Well, they weigh in on the specification as well.
That's right. So some parts of the implementation discussion happens before stage 2.7. Like, does this seem like a design that would be implementable? But then to get to stage three after that, we have to write tests, conformance tests. So this is test 262. Test 262 is a test of the full JavaScript language. It includes all the corner cases, or at least we hope it includes all the corner cases. And it's an open source project that's used by all the JavaScript engines. And you know this, ML, because you wrote some of the tests. Mm-hmm. So thank you for your contributions. Aww, there.
My pleasure.
And for stage three, then we have both the initial design, including the community, implementers, you know, thinking through logical implications. And then after stage three, we're saying to implementers, if you haven't already started implementing this, well, now it's somewhat stable. You have your tests, so you might want to think about implementing it because the committee can only move forward once we have some experience seeing if it works out in actual JavaScript engines. Sometimes engines try out a prototype implementation beforehand, and that can build some important information. Then at stage four, we have multiple engines implementing and shipping the feature, and it makes sense to put it in the JavaScript standard. So at that point, we merge the PR. You know, the ECMA 262 is just a normal GitHub repo. It has a CI that, you know, builds some markdown document into some HTML document, and that's the specification. Technically, it's like an editor's draft, and every year we have a cut of it. We have a version like ECMAScript 2023. Or ES 2015, which was the same as ES6. And that is what gets standardized formally. But I think if you just look at the current specification that includes all the stage four features that you can get to at tc39.es/ECMA262, then that's what I think of this, the JavaScript standard. Mm-hmm. It's the editor's draft, technically, but it's really the standard.
Yeah, and it's this book, believe it or not, folks. ECMA is still like a legal entity that exists in Geneva, where all the things in the world, apparently, whenever people have to talk to each other and work globally, things seem to be headquartered in Geneva. It's like the neutral safe zone of the world. But anyways, this book gets printed out. There's like an actual, like one of my former colleagues like sent me pictures of this. Like she went into this room in Geneva where all of the actual like JavaScript gets printed out. And it's like, it looks like, you know, it's like this big, thick bound paper. And, you know, there it is. Like it's like in its physical form. It's quite interesting how that happens because it's an actual standard that like it's an international standard. Manufacturers use it. Like all these different people rely on JavaScript to do very serious and important things. So, you know.
Yeah. But back in the day, you could write a letter to ECMA and ask them to just send you a hard copy of the standard.
Why'd they stop doing that?
Well, you know, there's printing costs and then there's, trees, you know, just, yeah, I think if somebody really wanted a hard copy of a standard, something could be worked out. The hard copies are still produced. They're archived in the Swiss National Library.
Right.
And that's part of what makes it a real standard in some sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. For sure. And just a couple really important points that you made there, Daniel. First of all, like amazing job summarizing that. Thank you so much for the wonderful explanation of this like super dense topic. I just want to clarify one thing. You said once something is kind of in stage four, the PR gets merged. It's not the test262 PR. It's the, you're talking about the actual draft PR to edit the spec, right? That there's a repo and
yeah.
Because I think you said the test262 repo. Right. So I think you just missed that up.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. The test262 PR can actually be merged after the proposal is at stage three, because even though it's not in the full standard, it's really useful for engines if they have access to those tests in the same test262 thing. So, you know, in reality, no engine gets 100% on that suite, partly because there's new things being merged, but partly because there are certain edge cases that we're still working out and need to fix in the spec.
Interesting. Oh, it's interesting that you said that we have to fix them in the spec. I thought that it was like, oh, you know, the way we wrote this code makes, you know, doing, for example, like tail call optimization. Remember, that was like Safari never implemented that or JSC never.
Oh, Safari was the only one to implement it. But that
Oh, sorry. I had that reversed. I apologize.
Tail call optimization. It's a tricky topic. I was involved when I was in the V8 team on coming up with our position, which was very subtle. I don't know if maybe it was too subtle, but if we had automatic tail call optimization, then we would drop some stack frames when you look at the error stack and that we were worried that it would make it hard to debug.
Interesting. Yeah, I had that reversed. Only one browser had implemented it. And then it was just like the other ones like said no, you know, for reasons. There was technical reasons, like you just said.
Well, we said, you know, it should be a specific syntax that you invoke on purpose when you want to do a tail call that's optimized.
That makes sense.
As opposed to it being implicit.
Yeah. And I would agree with that, especially because like you never know what you're breaking, right? Too, like with like the depth of the web. So yeah, again, really great summary. And, you know, just one thing I want to highlight for folks, like, you know, the TC39 has really been like kicking butt super hard since like ECMA script 2015/ES6 came out. It had this like big, you know, we had that big leap. And ever since then, like Daniel said, like all the other kind of subsequent releases of the specification they've been less eventful and I think better for the community actually as a result of that. Like it's ES 2023 just like landed quietly, you know, this past June or whatever. And there's new things, but it's not like this big hoopla all the time. So, I mean, it's nice to see that you all are kind of doing things sustainably. But I think for me, what makes the TC39 uniquely work well is that you have this perfect mix of implementers, right? So the people that are writing this C++ code like in the engines. And then you have language experts, like people who are like researchers, PhDs, or just, you know, really like true masters of language design, right? Polyglots. And then you have on the third part of this triangle, then you have like web developers. You have people that are like building things at companies. You have people building things for, you know, different consumers, you know, library authors, application developers. And you really need that kind of like trifecta of skills, I think, in order to kind of get it right. And so by the time a spec really lands, like especially even when it gets to this 2.7 stage, I think like it's very well thought out. And I think for me, the interesting part as somebody who's written tests for the language, tests really, really helped implementers. Like imagine having the ability to kind of TDD your specification, right? So like, I'm an engineer on JavaScript core. I'm implementing top level await. Me being able to have tests along the way while I'm implementing to see like what I'm doing right or wrong, like it greatly speeds up my process as a browser developer engineer. But on the flip side of that, for folks who are writing these tests, they're actually like the first, like I remember like when I was writing tests for Atomics, for example, like it was like the, I was like one of the first people on the planet, like hitting different edge cases with like, how do I do this in Atomics? How do I do that? And how, you know, what kind of a harness do I need? And how do I need to set this file up in order to make things work? And it's really interesting, like being that early, because you also get a chance to potentially give feedback to the people who wrote the spec and say like, this is difficult. This isn't working. Right. So it's actually this really nice chance to also further like polish up the spec.
Yeah. Like when you found that bug in my BigInt proposal.
Yes. Yes. I remember. Yeah.
What was the bug?
It was like the base was wrong. And it wasn't just me. Like it was Valerie and I were looking at it. And like basically the base that you had printed, it was like N64 versus like, I don't know, like the numbers were wrong. And if we implemented it that way, no computer would have been able to do it. Like, because it was just too, like it was too big of an int. You know what I mean? But yeah, we find bugs in the specs when we're writing tests too. So it's just, I don't know, tests are awesome. And just writing tests for JavaScript is super meta. Like you're using JavaScript to test JavaScript. Like it's fantastic. And even things like modules, like testing modules was also like unique, because then we had to set up like this whole like harness for like, how do you test modules using JavaScript? Like it's so, you know, but anyways, fun engineering challenge. And it was an honor to work on that stuff for a while. So,
and it's an open source project that you can contribute to.
Correct.
There's all these issues for like missing tests on the repo. And there's a number of maintainers of that who are happy to help you figure out how to write tests. So if you're interested, just, I don't know, go to the repository. It's at github.com/tc39/test262.
Yeah, we'll link it in the show notes. Great project. And even if you just want to look at tests to better understand how does map work, how does MapReduce work, like you can learn about specifications even just through reading tests, which is like my favorite way also to like learn new language features. But anyways, we're going to get off this nerdy topic because we have more nerdy topics to cover, which is what's new, right? So let's start with stage four and kind of work our way down. And there's too many new things for us to cover in one show. So I kind of gave Daniel like free rein to like come up with the things that he was most excited to talk about. And so we're gonna focus on those.
Well, I kind of wanted to ask you all, like, are there any language features you're excited about in JavaScript, whether they're being considered by TC39 or not? Nick, you're nodding. What are you thinking about?
If I let Amel answer, I bet she could answer it pretty quickly, right?
But I could answer, but you go. The question was at you, Nick. Don't redirect.
Oh, I know. I like it better when I'm not the one who brings up types on this show.
Oh,
types.
The type annotations proposal.
I'm very excited about the type annotations proposal.
I am too, for what it's worth, Nick, because that means maybe we can stop saying TypeScript and we can just go back to saying JavaScript, you know? Like,
it's still TypeScript.
Is it really? Is it, Daniel? I don't know.
Well, when people have like their JavaScript with types in js.doc comments, I don't know, that still seems like TypeScript, but everybody says no, it's suddenly not TypeScript because
it's an annotation. I mean, it's a comment.
Yeah, the thing that doesn't matter, because the most interesting part of TypeScript is the language server, so you'll get that no matter what.
Yeah. So type annotations is a stage one proposal that adds syntax to JavaScript where you can put types. It's to solve this problem where, you know, right now you have to choose between either writing TypeScript, in which case you have to use TSC to strip out the types before running the code, or use JS.doc comments, in which case the types are really ugly and then you're missing a bunch of features. So it only handles parts of your code. And instead, the idea is, what if we put types in JavaScript? But there's a problem. Type checking is really complicated. And also, TypeScript keeps evolving its type checking pretty rapidly, mm-hmm. in a way that's good. It keeps getting better.
What one might say, a breaking release every release, you know?
Yeah. That's not something we could do in JavaScript. We try to be compatible. We say web compatible. Mm. We try to not break the web with each release. Mm. Maybe there could be something that's technically a little incompatible, but it's not going to break too many websites. That's kind of the criterion.
And that's the interesting thing, I think, with that proposal is kind of where it will go and how it might evolve to handle that, to be like the stable JavaScript that we're used to, plus like without constraining too much the ingenuity that TypeScript might bring to future releases.
Yeah. So the idea is, you know, because the types don't do anything at runtime, you know, we don't actually want it to be that when you load your website, the first thing it does is this expensive type check calculation.
Yeah.
Those type checks should happen at build time, or they happen in your language server. and then what would it even do? It would just like pop up an error message. Like that's not how we do things on the web.
No, it would have Duke pop up, like Duke, the Java mascot guy. I don't know. I'm losing the thread here.
You mean that little carrot is named Duke?
I think so. The little
I didn't know that.
White guy. I thought his name was Duke.
Yeah, this is my signal to change the subject. So, hey, y'all, we can come back to this topic because it's a stage one thing. But yeah, I definitely am personally excited about that. The other thing I'm excited about is something Michael Rogers is also excited about, to the point where he specifically came and asked me to ask you, little Dan, where are his immutable types?
Yeah.
He wants record tuple. Like, so that's the proposal that I'm also very excited about. Propose, you know, bringing tuples into JavaScript. Like, that would be amazing.
Yeah. Michael Rogers he's been at DC39 meetings before. It would be great to have him back. I remember he brought this big box of like very fancy croissants or...
Oh, I thought you were going to say something else for some weird reason.
Yeah, and he brought pastries to share to the meeting, which is very nice.
Oh, nice. That's very sweet.
But yeah, records and tuples are a stage two proposal. They let you have immutable data types.
Mm-hmm.
The idea we had at first was that these would be primitives. So they would be like numbers or strings. You can compare them with triple equals. They compare by value. But we got some feedback from web browsers, from JavaScript engines, that this would be really complicated to implement. And in particular, developers seem to assume that they could do comparisons and that they would run in constant time if it's with triple equals. But that's really hard or maybe impossible to implement reliably.
Why, I wonder?
Well, even with strings, the comparison is sometimes kind of cached and sometimes linear. And it's already a big pain point for developers where they have to kind of figure out how the strings are being optimized to decide how to use them. So anyway, we have a rough plan. The rough plan with records and tuples is that they would just be objects instead of being primitives. So we would have immutable data types. They would be like a special frozen array, special frozen object, and it just wouldn't work to use triple equals. You'd have to use some like other equals method.
Interesting.
And that should be a lot easier for engines to implement while still meeting a lot of the goals. So for example, so
what are we losing with that though? What are we like?
One thing that we wouldn't be losing is the ability to use them as keys in maps and sets. Or at least we would have a version of maps and sets that compare those by value. So that's one of the big things that people want records and tuples for, so that you can have a kind of compound key.
That was such a political diplomatic answer, though. Like, this is like how I know you've been doing standards work for a long time. I asked you for the glass half empty and you gave me the glass half full.
I guess I was just twisting around your words because I wanted to say that positive point.
Yeah, of course. That makes sense. Thank you.
Sorry.
give me the real answer, though.
So, you know, we'll miss out on the triple equals. What'll happen is that each record and tuple will be its own object. Previously, it was going to be possible for an engine to do this operation called interning or hash consing, which is basically whenever you allocate a new record or tuple, it could check, is there already a record or tuple with this contents? If so, just return the existing one. And that's a pretty cool optimization, kind of. But really, with modern generational garbage collectors, the cheap allocations are the ones that are only in the nursery, the ones that are short-lived. The expensive ones are the ones that are long-lived.
Oh, nursery. Is this? I'm learning terms. I'm learning new lingo.
Oh, sorry.
This is fascinating.
So garbage collection, it's about how, you know, in JavaScript, you just have objects and then when you stop using them, they go away. That's because you have a garbage collector that goes around and cleans them up. But the garbage collector has its own cost. So the strategy that all browser JavaScript engines use these days is called generational garbage collection, where they have what they call a nursery. So when you allocate a new object, it goes in the nursery. And then you do collections just on the nursery, because it's about what's called the generational hypothesis, that most objects die young when they're in the nursery. Kind of grim terms.
Wow, this is so.
It's just, I didn't realize it was so dark.
This is actually what people call it. I don't know.
I know. This is fascinating. Please keep going. Just ignore our faces and laughter.
Isn't that how life works?
Yeah, it is absolutely. I mean, I would say life like 700,000 years ago worked that way. Like our infant mortality rates have definitely been on the decline for a long time as a human species.
Yeah, well, let's hope that doesn't happen with your JavaScript program. Because the thing is, when the nursery gets cleaned up, the nursery is way smaller than the old generation. So you really want the collections to happen just within the nursery. If you fill up the old generation, then you have to do a full GC, which takes more time. So anyway, all this means that interning is not something that you always want to do. You want to do it sometimes when something's really going to get reused or really going to get compared.
And interning is?
Interning is the optimization where you reuse the allocation.
Okay.
So if anyone ever told you, hey, you should really use like a free pool and reuse objects to make your program faster, that might be true, but a lot of the time it's not true because this generational garbage collection.
Yeah, and thank you for reminding me why I enjoy working with high-level languages. It's because of this.
Yeah, that's the whole point. You don't have to think about this.
Like, I don't want to think about it. I got bigger problems, and like, I got 99 problems and garbage collection 8-1. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
I can tell you that
that's
much.
The whole point.
I mean, it is and it isn't. You know what I mean? It's the meta problem, like, right? But it's like not the day-to-day problem. But yeah, Chris, you've been making faces this whole time, and I'm like super curious to like click into that. So you have anything to share?
Are you calling on me? Like,
yes,
my teacher? Like,
yeah, give me a feature.
Oh, no, not give
You're
me a feature.
You're in the nursery, Chris.
No, I mean, I wanna give me a feature request.
Okay.
Chris, anything to share?
No.
I can do it that way. I can say it in that voice if you'd like.
All right. No, so the thing is, so what I'm excited about is like more helper methods on maps and sets. Because every time I got a map, oh, I want to filter all this. Well, now I have to change it back to an array and do the filter. Or just stuff like that.
Yeah.
I would love those helper methods because I'd use them all the time. And I was really happy about group by until I used it. And it didn't do what I thought it should do.
That's good feedback for Dan. Can you tell us what is group by and then what did you expect it to do?
I kind of would have wanted the feedback earlier. So wait, let's talk about the map in set one and then talk about group by. So I have good news and bad news. New methods are coming to sets for union and intersection, and they're not coming to maps. The idea was that this is a stage 3 proposal, set methods. And it's focused around things like union and intersection. For things like filtering, you could do that both for maps and sets. You can get the iterator by doing dot values or dot entries, or just the symbol iterator. And then you can use the iterator helper's proposal at stage 3. You can do dot filter on any iterator. Actually, there's a new convenience method, iterator dot from. You can put that on the map. And then do dot filter on the result. You could dot map it.
Is this sync iterator helpers?
Sync iterator helpers, yeah. It's at stage 3. There was a web compatibility issue that forced it to be a little bit delayed. Iterator helpers should let you filter over a map or set. And if you want to union or intersection sets, then set methods do that. We had huge debates over these. There are so many details to work out. And a lot of this is about kind of what are the conventions that we're going to use going forward when we add things to the JavaScript standard library. So, you know, these are moderately big additions, but I hope that they'll pave the way for even more things so that you don't have to use an NPM package for something as simple as filtering over an iterator or, you know, unioning two sets or group by. Well, what was wrong with group by the way? How did it not do what you wanted?
I don't remember.
That's not helpful, Chris.
There's object.groupby and map.groupby, depending on whether you want it to be like strings as object keys or keys in a map.
Yeah. You know, and Daniel, actually, this is a good time to ask this question, which is like, you know, I know there's a lot of implementers on the committee, but do you ever kind of just for fresh eyes, right? Because there is obviously bias amongst everyone in the committee, like, you know, throw things at folks like Chris or other people just to kind of say, like, does this work and make sense, like, for you, right? I'm just curious.
We try. I mean, everything's open on GitHub for people to comment, and people who maintain proposals or championing proposals definitely read those comments and respond to them. Maybe sometimes it takes them a while, but general people take that seriously. Also, a lot of us go to conferences to speak about proposals or just to learn from different developers. I just came back from, well, I saw you at NodeConf EU. That was great. Yeah, in Ireland.
That was so fun.
And I was talking about one of the proposals, async context, and that's a good way to learn from developers. But yeah, this kind of podcast is good also. Generally, we're trying to get the feedback before a certain point, before stage 2.7 or stage 3. Because after a certain point in time, we just have to kind of make decisions and move forward.
Right, right.
So that always makes it hard when it's not clear when the point is that you should give feedback before. And so I'm always trying to do outreach to encourage people to give feedback earlier in the process. We've also had some specific outreach mechanisms. Like I created a couple of calls to talk to tools authors and also framework authors and some JavaScript educators. If you're interested in getting involved in those, please write me through any means of communication you could see on my GitHub page. I have a few ways that you could contact me. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we'd always like more participation in those things.
I retract my displeasure with group buy. I think it was user error.
Okay, that's good. Because I love group buy for what it's worth. I'm like, it does exactly what I wanted to do. And I wish we had that. When I was writing more code, I wish I had that. You know what I'm saying?
I, in fact, just had to write a wrapper because Node still doesn't have it.
Well, that's weird because Node just, it's the engine. I mean, Node doesn't do like...
Yeah, but it just came out. It's probably going to be until Node 22.
Yeah.
You'll have to wait until then to get it.
Yeah, until it's in V8, like, you know, and Node pulls in the latest version of V8, yeah.
I don't know if it's going to make it into Node 20.
Well, no, it's already shipped. Node's on 21.
Right, exactly. So I don't think it's going to be in Node 20.
Yeah. So y'all, really appreciate that. And if you're listening, everyone, basically, well, what I hear when Daniel says feedback early and whatnot is like, hey, if you're going to be paying attention to the TC39's repos, great. Like if you're going to watch anything, those are good repos to watch if you're really interested in seeing what's new with the language, specifically the proposals repo. But, you know, anything that's listed in stage 1 and 2, like those are really an active discussion. And so if you have feedback or if you want to jump in, like they work in the open intentionally because they want engagement and feedback from the community. So please like go check it out. We'll put all these links in the notes, but you want to go to the TC39's proposal repo and look at like early stage proposals and feel free to chime in.
Yeah. I want to especially encourage people to look at stage 2 proposals because those are the ones that are under the most strong active development that are kind of the furthest along and most concrete, where we would really like to work out all the details.
Yeah, and thanks for sharing that. So back to my list, because I want to go 4, 3, 2, 1. We kind of jumped all over the place. So stage 4, promise.withResolvers. So let's talk about that. What is that? And Dan, like, we want you to like explain everything to us like we're 5. Okay. And actually, I realized we were talking about tuples and I don't even know if everybody who's listening knows what a tuple is. So we'll if you're listening, we'll go back to that. We'll come back to that topic. Just hang tight. Okay. But for now, promise.withResolvers. Qu'est-ce que ça?
So promise.withResolvers it's something that my coworker, Peter Kletcha in Bloomberg did. It was actually his first project in TC39. So this is a little function that makes it easier to construct promises.
Did you say Jason?
Peter Kletcha.
Okay, got it. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. There's also a Jason Williams in my team who's involved in a lot of spec things as well.
Yeah, I got to meet them at Performance Now, actually. Or not this summer, this fall. Yeah, which was another amazing conference that I went to.
Yeah, he was there. There's a lot of cool stuff coming out of WebPerf Working Group. I wonder if you might want to talk about that sometime on this show.
Yeah, no, for sure. We have, I'm telling you, man, I'm booking shows into like March right now. Like it's kind of ridiculous. So we might have to start publishing 2 episodes a week to get through everything next year. So we'll see. We'll see. Anyways,
So for promise.withResolvers, right now the promise constructor, when you do new promise, you have to pass it a function, and then that function is passed to other functions for resolve and reject. And then you're supposed to launch the stuff within the function that you're passing. It's called the revealing constructor. And then the whole thing returns a promise. I think the idea behind this was that it would encourage people to use promises the right way or something. In particular, if you throw an exception within the function, within that callback that you're passing to the promise constructor, then it'll get caught and the thing will be rejected rather than, you know, throwing an exception, because you're not supposed to. When you have a function that returns a promise, it's supposed to always return a promise. If it has to throw, it should return a rejection. Anyway, that was lost on, I would say, 99.9% of people, the rationale for that, unfortunately. And instead, it just seems like extra work. You have to save off the resolve and reject functions that you could call them later. And this new form, promise.withResolvers, is just a simple function that you call. It doesn't take any arguments. It returns you an object with three named properties: the promise, the resolve function, and the reject function. And it's just saves you like an extra 5 lines of code that everyone has to keep writing over and over and over again.
Right. No, absolutely. It's so simple. Like it's kind of like duh, right? Like why mm-hmm. didn't we do this from the beginning? But I think for me, we didn't do this from the beginning because we didn't have, like, we had promise before we had the ability to like destructure in this way, and like const, and like all these things kind of landed at different times.
Destructuring did come out in ES6 and promises came out in ES6,
but because they were came out at the same time, I feel like that's not conducive to one thing relying on the other, right?
No, I think it had more to do with people at the time felt very strongly about this property that you shouldn't be using the resolve and reject function for very much, uh-huh. and that this would kind of hide them away. Uh-huh. And now we've all realized, well, these things just aren't going away.
Oh, yeah, no, they're super important.
That was one of the big things that I had when actual promises came to the language, because it didn't have things like this. And so it was kind of, you know, I had to do this extra 5 lines or whatever. Whereas I'm from the old world where Dojo deferreds exist, and they were awesome and did basically the same thing.
Yeah, we were debating calling this thing promise.deferred.
Oh, yeah.
But really, that only made sense to people like who were around back then. It only makes sense from a historical perspective. Actually, when I was on the V8 team, I removed promise.deferred from V8's promise implementation, because that was one of the that was one of the extra out of spec things that V8 had. Hmm. And the goal was to not do that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I didn't even know that kind of stuff happened in modern times, like post browser wars, where like there were things that are non-spec adherent that are kind of sugared on. Like, that's surprising to hear.
Well, it's because there were these active debates in TC39. Different people, actually different Google employees working at the same company, had different points of view and just sort of went with it. Post ES6, we're being a lot more organized about that.
Of course, that makes sense. Chris, you had something to say?
Yeah, so, I mean, it came out in 2015, so... Is it 2023 still?
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. However many years that is, I can't count them in my head right now. However many years later, I still feel naughty if I save those resolve and reject functions.
Me too.
And I always feel like I'm doing something wrong, because somewhere along the way we learned that you shouldn't do that. And I don't know where that came from.
Well, I mean, there should be some other API that returns a promise, and then you should just do then. But the cases where you need to save it off, where it's legitimate to do so, is when you have an API that has a callback or an event or something like that. You shouldn't really be using the resolve and reject functions when you're just dealing with a bunch of other promises. But yeah, I think that message was marketed a lot. Probably the new generation of programmers hasn't even heard it. And it didn't fully make sense, because nobody fully followed through on making promise-based APIs for everything. I mean, we have the Node FS promise APIs. We have, on the web, new APIs are made with promises. But in general, nobody went back and made promise-based APIs for all the old things.
Right.
I think we probably should do that, like with set timeout at least.
Oh my God. Set timeout as a promise would be game changing.
There's always a one-liner.
It would make you feel so much. It would always make you feel so much less dirty about using it. Like, you know, just a little less, like not too much, you know, I never feel good about set timeout. There's some indeterminism that I feel like I'm trying to smooth over whenever I use it, quite frankly.
Well,
like
I'm
bringing order to the indeterminism, but like I don't like it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. You don't want to use set timeout to like avoid a race condition or something.
You got it. But that's usually when I'm doing it, you know, when I don't have time to fix the real problem. Just got to band-aid it over, you know, but you know, hey man, that's called shipping to production. Like that's life. Okay. So we talked about promise.resolvers. That's stage 4. So that is coming to a browser near you. Pew, 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 pew. Okay.
Yeah. So there's a lot of stage 4 proposals, and generally in ES 2023, we have a bunch of standard library proposals. So we have a bunch of new methods that are being added to existing JavaScript classes that just make them work a little bit better. We have a bunch of these in stage 3 as well. I mentioned set methods and iterator helpers. Also in stage 3 is the temporal proposal. So temporal.
Yes. Oh, yeah, hold on. I want to stick with stage 4. So
I don't think we have time to go through all of them though.
Oh, we don't. Oh no. I wanted to talk about array grouping because I do think array grouping and error cause are interesting.
Okay.
And there's also a theme. There's also a theme there, right, which is like maybe we're kind of like we're improving our standard library within JavaScript sort of, right? Like so array grouping, real quick.
So array grouping, this is, you know, kind of like the Lodash group by method, or is it called group? I can't remember.
Oh yeah, Lodash is underscore group by, if I'm not mistaken. Like I think it was.
Yeah. So yeah, we made those as methods on object and map. So at first we thought, okay, array instances will just have a group by method. You'll have an array, you'll do dot group or dot group by or something like that. And then it'll give you, you know, the output of the Lodash method. And we wanted two versions, one version that outputs an object like Lodash does, and one version that outputs a map in case you don't have string keys, in case you're comparing something else. So the problem was we kept having trouble coming up with a name. It's really hard to add names to methods on array because lots of stuff like type checks, but it's not just because it exists already. Sometimes people add extra methods to arrays. Or sometimes...
You mean prototype pollution?
Yeah, prototype pollution. Or sometimes they're not even doing that.
There's a way to do it safely.
Yeah, kind of. Sometimes people check whether something has like a dot group property to say, oh yeah, if it has a dot group property, then it's an instance of my class. Otherwise, it's an array. So then if you add dot group to arrays, suddenly everything messes up. And that actually happened in this case. So we decided, yeah, we're not going to add more methods to arrays. This is just too bad. Too terrible, because what happened was browsers actually implemented it, they shipped it, and then they found it breaks lots of websites.
So it's just object and map, even though the proposal is called array grouping. So why did the proposal name not change?
Well, it still groups arrays. Well, now it groups all iterables, so it's kind of more
okay.
General.
Oh, iterables. Okay, I see. That makes sense.
I mean, because it used to be an array method, and now it's a... Now, because it's an argument, it's just going to accept any iterable.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then the Lodash group by, which does pretty much the exact same thing. So now this is part of the language, yay. But it has 850,000 downloads a week. And so this is where I wish like NPM had like this memo feature where it's like, by the way, this package can now be deleted. Like it'd be cool if we had this broadcast, you know? Honestly,
well,
like...
Lodash being deleted is kind of a long way off.
No. Well, no, this package specifically, like this, you know, hopefully you're downloading just that one package and not all of Lodash.
You can use npm deprecate to mention it on that one package, whoever is.
Yeah, but I meant like as a community, I wish we had like, you know, just like a weekly community broadcast, like, you know, just like everybody, you know.
Yeah, that kind of would be nice in some ways. The good thing about JavaScript maintaining compatibility is that you can keep using Lodash and we're not going to break it.
Correct.
And you just have another option that's kind of easier. It's kind of made a little bit better.
Right.
But it's just an option. But this is not like in Python 3 means you have to do this big upgrade process. I mean, maybe ESM is brings that, but at least group by doesn't come with that.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. All right, so moving on, I know we have a lot to cover. Error cause.
Yeah, error cause is when you call the error constructor, you can pass an extra cause. So this happens, for example, if you have a function that calls some other function, then that inner function throws an exception, and then the outer function catches it, and it wants to explain sort of at a higher level what's going on. But also, you want to point to the inner thing so that you can see more details about what's going on. So error cause lets you bring those both together just based on the standard error constructor. So you can use the dot cause property to figure this out.
What's like the semantic difference between that and an aggregate error that contains one error?
Well, aggregate errors, they're like all on the same level. And error cause is like you have one that's like the main error and the other one is the cause.
Oh, okay. I'm using aggregate error wrong.
Ah.
Thank you.
Well, whatever works.
Yeah, no, this is pretty cool. And I love this because I think for me, error management and like just the observability, kind of the semantics around that, like just gets so much nicer with this. And it's just easy to kind of abstract into a nice little helper and just like standardizes throughout your whole code base. And then all of a sudden, like it's nice. So just props to whoever pushed this. Like, I think it's really great. So thank you. And it's now stage four. So yay. Very exciting. So we can move on to stage three, but you have something more to say on this, Daniel.
All the stage four proposals, when January comes, then they get rolled into the new JavaScript standard. After then, things that happen during the year of 2023 mm-hmm. don't actually make it into ES 2023.
Okay, so this is it'll be officially part of 24.
Oh, sorry. Yes, this is all ES 2024. So
okay. Exciting. That's a big deal.
What up, nerds? Jared here. If you listened to our React Jam episode at the end of October, you already know that I judged their fall competition and had a great time doing it. So many cool games. Rock, Paper, Shoot was my favorite, a modern take on two classics. Rock, Paper, Scissors meets Pong. If you missed the fall competition, no worries, because the Winter React Jam is taking place December 26th through January 7th. And yes, I will be judging once again. So get involved, it's a ton of fun, and there's cash prizes too. Learn more at reactjam.com. Once again, that's reactjam.com. Let's do this.
All right, so moving on to stage three. So now we're getting into kind of like stuff that's either like very close to officially shipping or still in discussion, like stage two and one. So let's talk about decorators, because this has just been like, when this thing officially gets to stage four, I think there's going to be like a worldwide JavaScript party, like led by Pitbull, you know, Mr. 305, like, honestly, because...
What ECMA standard is Pitbull 305?
What? Who is Pitbull? I'm missing these special...
If I have to tell you who is Pitbull, yeah, the rest of this podcast is basically going to have to be dedicated to it. So I'll leave that for an offline discussion the next time I see you in person.
All right,
okay. All right. But point being is I think everyone is going to celebrate because this baby has been in the can for a long time. So what's going on?
Yeah, Decorator started all the way back in 2014 based on Ron Buckton and Yehuda Katz working together on an initial thing that got implemented in TypeScript and Babel with some minor differences. Mm-hmm. But then based on feedback, it evolved over the years in committee pretty slowly. There was a lot of opposition from engines initially because initial versions were kind of too dynamic. They were going to be too hard to optimize. And actually, Michael Westrasse of Mobix, he benchmarked the final signals and found that they were 30% faster than the original signals. So we did actually achieve some performance improvement in practice. Anyway, they went through a lot of changes over the years. Eventually, Yehuda dropped out, and then I was working on that proposal also with Ron. And then I dropped out, and Kristen Hewlett-Garrett got involved, working with Ron, who has an amazing amount of constancy. But this was all together with a broader group of people, including Niccolo Ribaudo
and others who have these regular calls. So we went through all these different iterations of what decorators should be and eventually settled on something that works both from an expressiveness standpoint in terms of letting decorators express things that we hope they would express. For me personally, I really wanted it to be that you could decorate a private field or method and have that work, which didn't work in the original version. And for implementers, make sure that it was kind of consistent enough to be implemented fast. And working with framework authors, we ensured that it met the various different needs that frameworks had. One of the things that we fixed up at the last minute was, for a while, we were going to make it so that if you have an exported class, you have a class decorator, then the export initially came before, well, initially, like in TypeScript and the first version of Babel, first you had the decorator and then you had the export keyword. And then it got switched, actually initially by accident, but then some people on the committee really liked it, the order. So you would put export and then the decorator. And finally, we decided at the 11th hour that you should be able to use either order, because people were pretty worried about the difficulty upgrading from one version to the other. It's going to require a lot of changes in documentation and such. Maybe it wasn't a big problem, but it was kind of nice that we were able to take the feedback from the decorator community and make sure that the proposal, you know, listened to it. Anyway, now it's at stage 3. It's implemented in TypeScript. There's some implementations in progress in engines, but I think they're somewhat early. So I wouldn't expect that that's going to be usable directly in your browser tomorrow, but in the next couple of years, we'll
probably. But it's in the works. Yeah. In the next couple of years. Wow. Even the implementation, that's amazing. So it's taking a while. I understand why. I mean, I think implementers were the loudest to contest the, like, why this was going to be really hard to do, right?
Yeah,
if I remember correctly, like the first go around.
The thing is, they always gave objective reasons for what was hard about it. You know, you can't just stand up in committee and say,
stop. I don't want to. Yeah.
You have to give reasons for what you're doing.
You're not my real dad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Got it. Okay.
So that's what helps us keep working and keep being able to make decisions that we really share. We're able to really, even though we're coming from different points of view, able to work these things out.
Right. No, that's really cool. So Decorator Stage 3 coming soon-ish, big on-ish. But the shape of the proposal, like in terms of the actual API, how it works, all of that stuff is like pretty, like that's stable,
yeah.
Right, Daniel? So if people want to start learning how it's going to work, and can folks use it through Babel now, I guess? That's the other question.
Yeah, you can use it through Babel, through TypeScript.
And the TypeScript version is like the updated, like it's the spec compliant version. It's not the like the runaway train version from years ago.
Well, they still have both. I mean, TypeScript, you could still use the experimental decorators flag to get the old decorators behavior. At least I think that's how you invoke it.
Huh.
There was a thing where decorators metadata, kind of core piece of decorators, was at stage 2 for some point when main decorators were at stage 3, but now it's all at stage 3 together.
Okay, interesting.
So maybe it'll all be implemented in a year, but from a standards timeline, like a year or two means, yeah, you're on track. This is good. It's happening. I got used to these really long timelines.
Of course, absolutely. Yeah, I'm just being facetious about like 2 years being a long time, but in standards world, that's like a blink of an eye. Okay, so we don't have a ton of time to talk about all of the other amazing things. So I want to just pick out like 2 or 3 more things, and then we've got other things to discuss. So temporal, I think we should talk about this because this is like the thing that we've also been waiting on for a while. And it's parked in stage 3. It has been for at least 2 years now, I think. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean,
I remember. Yeah.
Temporal it's been at stage 3 for a while, but I think it's really getting to this turning point where it's done and going to start shipping soon. So temporal is a new date time library in JavaScript. You already have JavaScript dates, but those are really broken in some core ways. For example, you have methods on the same date that work in terms of UTC and the local time zone. But the local time zone isn't even part of the date. If you move your phone from one time zone to another and you have the web page open, then it will make the local time zone methods return things based on your new time zone that you joined later. And all the browsers have these fancy code paths that invalidate caches and such when you change time zones to implement this. And I don't know, it's useful in some ways, but it's also weird. Like, why not have two types? One type for an absolute UTC time and one type for a local time that has a time zone. So that's what Temporal does. It splits out date time types based on what pieces of data that you have. For example, if you have just a time and you don't have a day, then you just use the class for times. So Temporal has a number of different types. It has good integration with internationalization. So you can use Intel datetime format together with all these different temporal types. There's a type for durations and a way to format those. And you can do calculations on them. So you could say, what's the time 1 hour from now? But it's not like date where you're, you know, doing set hour, hour plus one. It actually implements the calculations correctly. And it does so with no mutation. So it's like Luxon in that the date time that it's representing doesn't change. It's kind of immutable. When you do a calculation, you get a new one. So you can go to the temporal documentation page at tc39.es/proposal-temporal/docs. And there's a cookbook with lots of examples. And there's a full polyfill. And I'm really, really excited for this to get out there.
Is the polyfill like safe to use? Because like the last time I was on a team evaluating this, because we really didn't want to pull in Moment for this new project. But of course, like everyone and their mama is stuck with Moment and everyone is counting down the day where they can delete Moment and just start using Temporal, because obviously it's a huge package that takes up a lot of bytes. And so I'm just wondering, this polyfill, like, is it stable enough for folks to start considering integrating it? Because if you're working on a greenfield project and, you know, you've got low traction on the usage right now, and I would be willing to take the chance on the polyfill if it was decent.
Well, unfortunately, the team maintaining the polyfill has been really focused on the needs for it in a kind of specification context to just be completely correct rather than being totally production ready. And ultimately, yeah, maybe we would have to ship the time zone database anyway if we wanted to. Well, unless we could be like Luxon and use the Intel date time format for that. Anyway, there's a lot of messy decisions that you have to make when making a date time library really production ready. And we know how to do that engineering work kind of generally, but it just hasn't been done. But this is an opportunity for, you know, contributions. The polyfill that was written by the proposal authors is there. It's open source. We'll have a link to it in the show comments. And people there would love to have contributors work on productionizing it and are happy to mentor folks to do so.
Nice. Yeah. You learn a ton and get to help everyone else along the way.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Thanks you so much for that context. And yeah, I'm so personally tied to this specific proposal because I'm really close friends with some of the Moment JS engineers that did the right thing and deprecated Moment and did the right thing and took Moment and put together this proposal for Temporal. Like, they're the ones that actually helped drive this. So for me, this is just like another really great story of how innovation from web developers, you know, helped kind of shift the web, you know, forward. And it's a really nice circular story where we get to see like it come kind of full circle and be part of the web platform. And then we're going to have a show on this. So we're just waiting for it to like officially hit one browser and like move into stage four. But we're going to have a big celebration about this with the Moment.js team and the folks who champion this. And so it's going to be like an epic mega show, but we're just obviously we're waiting on it to land because we don't want to get excited and tell everyone to start using it and then they're just like, wait, what?
Like, oh yeah, you know? It'd be really cool if we had the production grade polyfill ready by then too.
Yeah, that would be nice. That would be very nice because then all you're doing is deleting the polyfill code, but then but the rest of your code stays the same. It's like the best kind of situation.
So Temporal just reached this milestone where there was one part of the proposal that led the proposal champions to go to IETF to standardize a new extension on, you know, ISO 8601, the date format, because they wanted to represent time zones and calendars inside of that, because Temporal can represent those things. And it was important to, you know, be able to serialize and deserialize those. So they actually got it added in IETF. We didn't bother with ISO yet, but IETF has released I would get it wrong if I said what the actual stage of the IETF process was. Obviously, the goal is to publish a request for comments, but then you have several requests for comment before that. And I don't know, it got to a good stage where we think it's standard enough, it's finished enough for browsers to ship.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. So we have like, we're talking about stage three right now.
Yeah.
And I'm going to kind of switch gears to go into stage two. There's like over 20 proposals in stage two.
Oh, yeah.
That's huge. We're not going to obviously have time to talk about all of them. We'll link to the proposals doc in the show notes, and we'll specifically link to the ones that we've talked about here so that you don't have to click twice. But for now, I think the one that I'm the most excited about is records and tuples. We talked about this a little bit earlier, but can we just explain it to people like they're five, because we didn't really quite set the context for like what the hell are records and tuples. We just started talking about it.
So honestly, I would prefer to talk more about records and tuples once there's been more work documenting and publicizing the
That's totally fair.
The revised version. Right now, it's just going to be confusing. I can give a brief answer to that question, but I don't want to spend too much time on the topic.
That sounds like a plan.
Yeah, records and tuples, the point of them is to be immutable versions of objects and arrays. And that can be really useful because if you have, you know, your state in Redux or something, or anything that you're passing to use memo, I guess Redux is considered passé or something, but you know, we still like it in Bloomberg. I don't know.
Oh, no, Redux is great. And Redux is not dead at all. It's just taken like a new life in, I think, Redux toolkit, and which is the way I would use Redux if I was using it today.
Anytime you have your state, like you don't need Redux to maintain your state, but it's a good way to do so. But anytime you have your state centralized, you have this object or array that has a bunch of other objects or arrays inside of it, and then you're going to change it maybe with a bunch of, you know, object and array spread patterns. And the important thing is you don't want to mutate it. If you mutate it, then you kind of lose the game because it could make other things that are using like use memo or something, it could make them get the wrong answer because it won't do these comparisons properly. So React might forget that it has to re-render something if you do mutation instead of returning a new object. So the important thing is to use immutable objects. Or, you know, there was a time when everyone was using immutable JS, but now everyone just uses normal arrays and objects, which is fine. The thing is, if you use normal arrays and objects, you can just mutate them and fall into this trap. People end up having to copy their state, like every frame, every re-render, they copy this object graph just to avoid the risk that they're going to mutate part of it. And that ends up causing a lot. You know, copying itself takes time. The re-renders that triggers takes time. Sometimes, you know, there are a million ways to write all this stuff. So records and tuples gives you this built-in immutable object and array system that also has this built-in deep comparison that can be used to see if something changed.
Okay, so I'm going to quickly shift this over into module expressions and declarations. That's also another stage two proposal that I'm very excited about. Could you just very briefly tell us about that? And then we want to talk about async context.
Yeah, so module declarations and expressions are about having inline modules inside of other JavaScript. So ES modules right now, you have one file that contains one module, but that doesn't fully work for a number of reasons. Sometimes you want to start up a worker with code that you have in one file. It can be kind of difficult bundler-wise to package another file and refer to it. I mean, bundlers have worked this out, but it ends up being kind of a configuration mess sometimes. It's nice if you can have everything in one piece of code. So module expressions let you have one of these modules just inline in your JavaScript, and then you could refer to it and pass it to a worker or import it.
Export it and read it from another file.
Yeah. But then if you want to export it and read it from another file, you might want to use module declarations. So the thing about if you have a module expression, you can only really dynamically import it. You can't use the static import statement because it's not there in the namespace.
Yeah.
And module declarations, what it does is it makes a statically known namespace that has these different locally defined modules. So all you do, the code looks really intuitive. It's just module and then the name and then a curly bracket, and contents of the module, closing curly bracket. There is a little problem that kind of conflicts with TypeScript's kind of old deprecated module construct. It's just a synonym for namespace.
You mean the one that they created when they went off the script with JavaScript?
Well,
like, as in, like, it was TypeScript and not JavaScript?
You know?
It was AtScript.
In 2012, 2013, that made perfect sense. There was, like, nothing for them to align to. There wasn't.
Yeah, but I guess I have so little sympathy for that, honestly. But I think it's just because I'm still a little upset that parts of TypeScript are not standard JavaScript. Like, I'm very crispy about that, personally speaking.
I mean, what I thought that was to prevent Google from forking TypeScript to create AtScript. And it was a compromise. To
really?
Get TypeScript to keep going.
Well,
because yeah, they wanted AtScript for Angular.
Yeah, they needed a lot of features. But modules, I don't know exactly where modules got introduced in all this. But modules are good. They're a thing. Now the TypeScript module keyword is just a kind of synonym for namespace. There is a real problem that needs to be solved before we would do something like module declarations, which is that there's a lot of types indefinitely typed, even ones that are generated, that use the module keyword. And they have to be switched to namespace before we could even consider this. But then people probably have private code that does the same thing. So I'm kind of sympathetic. At the same time, it's good that now TypeScript has finally actively started deprecating the module keyword.
Fantastic. Good choice, team. Good one.
Yeah, and to be clear, I was wrong. I was thinking of decorators still for some reason.
Yeah. Yeah, the Angular team really wanted decorators.
Yeah. And I understand why. I mean, decorators is a huge part of, like, working with Angular code. So anyway, so great description and great summary. And so the net benefit.
So I think module declarations will let bundlers. You still need bundlers, and bundlers will still do more than like concatenate modules because they implement all kinds of optimizations like module inlining. But it allows for a simple kind of bundler that just outputs module declarations instead of implementing its own loader. So right now, every time you use a bundler, it has no way of using native JavaScript modules. Maybe it can wrap everything in native ESM, but it can't use native ESM internally because there's no way that's efficient to have that include multiple different modules that are importing each other. So it ends up having to implement a CJS or AMD loader, which is just, I don't know, it's just kind of sad. Like, I was hoping that we would get native JavaScript modules. Maybe that's too ideological or something, but something I was hoping for.
I'm a little confused as to why. I don't think I followed, like, why can't it use ESM?
Oh, you can, if you want to take a bunch of JavaScript modules and put them in one file without module declarations, sure, you can do that, but you have to do that with the bundler implementing its own internal notion of modules. It will do the ESM to CJS transform internally to make it work.
But let's say I'm not using a bundler and I'm just using vanilla.js. Like, what then?
Yeah. So if you just use vanilla.js, you can use module declarations to put a bunch of things together efficiently, kind of building your own little bundler.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're making a little case for something, but like that's its own show.
Yeah.
And
we don't
I'm
have to.
Like fascinated, the fascinating. So we can move on to our last spec that we can dig into. And then I'm really excited to talk about this new thing called Winter CG with you. So tell us about what is async context, which is also another stage two proposal. And why is it important?
Async context gives you the ability to share information across an asynchronous data flow. So what do I mean by that? I mean, if you have some data, maybe you store it in a variable and then you await it. Well, if it's a local variable, you can read it before or after the await. But if it's a global variable, you kind of want to save and restore that global variable. So one concrete example is with distributed tracing, with OpenTelemetry, you want to remember kind of which span ID you're using.
Kind of like your request header.
Yeah, you want to be able to send it in your request header, but you also want to include it in your log messages so that then you can recover a distributed trace. So the span ID.
Your request ID, sorry, is what I meant, not request header. Kind of like your request ID, being able to kind of pass that along all the handshakes, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like some
value.
Exactly.
That's what the span ID is for.
Yeah, yeah.
So you want to hold it in a global variable, but if you do async await, then it doesn't get restored on the await because some other thread might come in and need it for something else. So this was raised as a really important issue within WinterCG. WinterCG is this new group that is working on standardizing JavaScript for all web intercompatible runtimes. That's where Winter comes from. especially in servers. So in servers, this comes up really frequently. It's really important for logging and for distributed tracing to have access to this kind of storage. They have a way to do so right now in V8 with promise hooks, but that is slow, it's unstable, and it's not available in browsers. And unstable in the sense that V8 has it now, but it's just a V8 specific thing. It's not a standard thing. So it could go away in the future via their deprecation process if they decide. So the solution is to make a new thing, async context, which is specifically for storing these variables that have this property where they work in callbacks across await and such. And this was an effort that was jointly done between TC39 and WinterCG. We're in WinterCG. We have the different server runtimes gathered so that we could discuss the needs together. And then in TC39, we developed the actual standard based off of it. So WinterCG doesn't directly publish its own standards, but it's a place to discover and to develop descriptions of shared needs between different server environments. So then we could figure out how that should affect standards. Part of WinterCG is defining a minimum common API, a common environment for all things. So you might call this like WinterCG compliant. Actually, some people might already be claiming to be WinterCG compliant, but we have not defined what this means yet. So it's a little early. Actually, we're working on opening up a new TC in ECMA. Maybe it'll be TC55. Or you could call it Winter TC. And that would be where we could publish standards related to Winter CG.
This is so much because I'm like still like kind of jaw drop on the floor around async context and how awesome it is. But I also like can't wait. I'm like so eager to like, I'm foaming at the mouth to like dig into Winter CG. And what I want to understand is why was this something that couldn't just be in the TC39? Like as in what, was it just like this group of people isn't technically part of ECMA? And there's so many questions. So like, I don't know where we start. Like,
well, one thing that I like about Winter CG is, so it's a W3C community group. That's what CG stands for. And that means that anybody can join. It's completely open. You just have to sign on to the intellectual property policy. And that's a really good quality for this kind of group because it makes sure that we don't exclude anybody who would be an important stakeholder. Also, the initial thing from WinterCG, this minimum common API, it's a set of web APIs. So it's a set of things like we say, yeah, set timeout should be available in all these environments and fetch should be available, but maybe a different version of fetch.
Okay, so let's set the environments. What are these environments, right? So, and let's maybe set the groundwork first around, so TC39 typically targeting JavaScript runtimes, JavaScript engines, right? Like things typically that run in a browser or node context.
Right,
Chakra Core, V8, JavaScript Core, SpiderMonkey, right? What else?
Yeah. TC39 is for the JavaScript engines themselves. So like all those things you listed. And then WinterCG is for things that go on top of that. Like Node, Dino, Bun, Cloudflare Workers. Bloomberg has its own kinds of mm-hmm. these.
Oh yeah.
We're also integrating Node a lot.
Right.
So these server environments like Dino and like Cloudflare Workers, ultimately they're all aiming to be pretty web compatible. And this is also the case with Node and Bun. Really, they have a lot of the same goals in mind, and it doesn't make sense to it will be useful for programmers if they can be as compatible with each other as possible. So then code can be portable.
Absolutely. We don't want lock-in. We want standards, right? And you're bringing... So this is kind of an effort, if I'm understanding this correctly, this is an effort to bring standardization to these kind of like higher level JavaScript server runtimes. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So the goal is not to say...
And would Bun technically be part of something like this in the future or at present?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we really hope that Bun will join WinterCG.
Okay.
We're definitely like watching what they're doing and hoping that we can all align.
Okay, so can you give us some examples of things that you are actively trying to standardize? So obviously this async context thing came out of that, which is cool. But like, what's an example of like where something is working one way in Cloudflare Workers and another way in Dino and another way in Node?
One that people are working really hard on is fetch, making sure that you have fetch like in the browser available in servers. And these environments all have their kind of fetch, but sometimes they're a little bit different from each other. There are a lot of cases where the fetch standard for web browsers just doesn't make sense in servers. For example, when it says you need the right cores headers to make a cross-origin request, if you're a server, you're already kind of privileged enough to request to whatever website you want. So it doesn't make sense to require cores headers on cross-origin things or enforce the same origin policy in general. So there's work ongoing to specify exactly how fetch should work on server environments.
Wow. And so where would that standard get published is my question.
It depends. Different things in Winter CG go in different places. We kind of hope that fetch, we can ultimately upstream this within the WhatWig fetch standard.
But is that like a scope creep for WhatWig folks? Because like they're not often thinking about the server, right? Like they're just like, we need these damn browsers to talk to each other and talk the same way. You know what I mean? And so like adding this server runtime context actually is a bit of a scope creep for WhatWig in terms of like things that they specify.
Yeah, in some sense. But in another sense, it's something that some WhatWig contributors have expressed openness to. So we'll just have to see. You know, plan A is get it upstream in WhatWig, and plan B is, you know, we publish a fork. Other parts won't go in WhatWig. For example, the common minimum API, just the listing of all the APIs that are supposed to be supported, that will have to go, you know, someplace else. It's not a web standard. It's not on the web. And so, yeah, so we're trying to establish an ECMA technical committee to publish that.
Okay, so this is like beyond fantastic, like amazing work, you all, seriously. And as a community, we get to benefit from this level of standardization because exactly what you said means like we don't have to, there's no lock-in. You know, if I want to move my code, lift and shift it, like I lift and shift without using a bunch of proprietary APIs. Like granted, we've seen with Deno, like there's already language level tools, right? Like that they've put in with this KV store and that being something that you use when you're using a paid service. Like there's, it's never going to be 100% interoperable, but having at least a subset that is and specified, like that is very exciting. And I just want to say yay. I also want to give you some free advice, Daniel, which is like, you're doing something new. And, you know, I think trying to kind of work within the constraints that like the existing landscape, it doesn't have a clear space for something like Winter CG from a standards perspective. And so I wouldn't be afraid of just kind of like having a whole new committee within ECMA. Like that just feels like the right thing to do. And also, I really think published specified standard docs need to come out of this work as well. And I think those need to be independent. Like, I don't think they need to be part of WhatWig or like ECMA. Like, I think they can be referenced and linked in both of those spaces, but this feels like a standalone thing, to be honest.
I mean, yeah, some things are standalone and some things are not, because some things are, sometimes we've been adding extra APIs to web browsers to make them work better kind of in all places. And one of those was this tiny library function called response.json that makes it easier to construct a response from, like, if you're writing a service worker. But it's also useful in, you know, the Cloudflare Workers API for web servers. So we're really interested in both sides, both doing some of our own thing and in aligning. So one other place where we're thinking about doing our own thing is in socket APIs, like TCP, raw TCP socket. That is not safe to give to websites. Maybe it could be given to like a super duper PWA with extra permissions. That's something that there's some early discussion about in the W3C. But honestly, they've been talking about that for a long time. So depending on how those discussions go, we might try to work with them, or we might define our own, you know, Winter CG library that would be like a built-in module. So that's still new ground. Then that would be developed in Winter CG. So the technical development happens all in the open in that CG and then standardized in TC55. Mm-hmm. So right now the ball is in my court to get TC55 started, because Winter CG agreed on it in principle that we're going to try to work with ECMA, but we have to define the scope and statement of goals for the year.
That might be a committee I'm interested in joining, by the way. Like,
oh yeah, please.
Yeah, especially if I end up at the place that I think I'm gonna end up working. I'm like in the middle of interviewing right now. Well, I'm flirting with companies right now. I shouldn't say I'm interviewing. I will start interviewing in the new year. And if I end up where I'm gonna end up, or if I end up where I'd like to end up, you know, then it would be especially poignant for me to join this. But yeah, very cool.
Yeah, so is something like defining what a package manifest looks like, is that part of Winter CG scope?
Oh yeah, there's definitely interest in Winter CG in investigating package JSON or other kinds of package manifests. We have a bunch of work streams, and we made an initiative from Ethan Arrowwood, made a work stream for looking into package JSON. But I'm not sure what happened once that was started. Definitely Node's package JSON is something that a lot of different things implement parts of. Seems important.
Okay, so that's super cool. So what's going on with TG4 and source maps? This is something I keep hearing about. Can you shed some light on this? Are you all trying to standardize source maps or something?
Yeah, so source maps are mapping of JavaScript source. When you have a minifier or a bundler, then it's going to do this transformation on source where you have JavaScript in and JavaScript mm-hmm. out, but the out hopefully is more efficient. But then when you're debugging, you kind of need to know what the original was, even though the engine's been writing this bundler output. So you need a mapping that you can go from the minified code, from the output, back to the input, the full code. And source maps have been this mechanism to solve that problem. And they came out more than 10 years ago. But the standard for source maps was a bit informal. It was just a description in a Google Doc. It was kind of ambiguous. And different people implemented it in different ways.
Oh, wow. I did not know that.
Just a little bit, just around the edges. And yeah, this totally gets on people's nerves if they're ever developing either browser dev tools or build tools. You run into this problem really quickly where it's just not clear how to do things correctly. And you just get an endless stream of bugs due to the interaction of all these different systems. So yeah, we really wanted to fix this in Bloomberg because we have a lot of developers debugging via source maps. Actually, we have our own feature that we added to source maps locally called Pasta Source Maps, Pasta. Which improves some of the information. Yeah, it's pretty accurate stack trace analysis.
Oh, fancy. Nice acronym.
And so we wanted that information to be part of the standard, but we also wanted to, in addition to making sure that the standard was unambiguous, we wanted to make a process where more things could happen. So in the end, the group is working together on both this sort of correctness track, which is fixing up the specification so that it could be a real standard that we could publish, and on the features track, we're thinking about things like standardizing the metadata for pasta source maps. Google made this ignore list feature that we all kind of like and want to put in the standard.
And so the standard, who's going to implement the standard and where is it going to get published? And who, what's the committee responsible for standardizing it? Is this a Winter CG thing or is it something else?
Oh, it's a task group of TC39.
Okay, so that's the TG4.
So it's like TC39 can, any ECMA TC can sprout its own like mini subcommittees whenever it feels like. And that's what we did with TG4.
And those also get incrementally numbered, like TG4 oh, task maybe. Group 4. So there's only been three other task groups before
yeah,
this?
Yeah, yeah.
Or do you guys start at index 0? TG0.
TG1 is the main TC39.
Okay.
Okay. And then TG2 is, well, the reason, there was some reason that it was started that way because it became a royalty-free task group.
I'm just surprised that y'all don't start at 0. I mean, I would fully have expected you all to start counting at 0 like real programmers. You know, that's well, my biggest disappointment.
These document numbers, they go by their own rules. So TG2 is for internationalization for ECMA 402. TG3 is for security. And TG4 is now for source maps.
What about that other TC, like the secure runtime? I think it was TC53 or something like that.
Oh, TC53. That's defining a bunch of built-in modules for embedded systems.
Right, right, right. Is that still active? Because I was there when that committee started, like at Boku. I remember like Rick Waldron.
Yeah, they just had a meeting in California.
Nice. Yeah, I think Rick and Jory were like sponsoring that and making that happen. And I was like so excited to see stuff gets specified for like embeddable, you know, code. And hey, like there's a different level of security and different level of considerations that you need to take when, you know, thinking about running code and firmware. And so it's very, very cool. So congratulations on Winter CG being a thing. It sounds like there's a need, and I'm happy to see that that need is being funneled positively through collaboration and standards, you know, across the board. We'll put a link into the show notes for folks who want to join. Again, it's an open committee. So if you got opinions, they got eyes and ears. they can give you feedback, or you can chime in.
Make sure to put that comment earlier when we were talking about Winter CG.
Yes.
Hey, Jared here in post. I tried to move that comment earlier, but it was just too hard to fit in. You can just like do it in your brain, right? Yeah, you can do it. Thanks.
I kind of want to end this podcast talking about open source sustainability, you know, and just taking a step back and looking at like all these people that are contributing to standards work in various capacities. Many of them work at browser companies and or companies with pretty big stakeholders of the web, right? Like Intel and Samsung and Sony and, you know, companies that really rely on the web to be healthy and functional for their products to work well for users, right? So those folks, but then there's folks like, you know, from Boku and Igalia that are, you know, kind of independent consultants, you know, being paid by various companies to work on different initiatives, right? Because of their expertise on the platform. And so like, where are we with just general open source sustainability, and more importantly, like making it easy for people who don't work at these big companies to be part of the conversation when like shaping the web?
Yeah, well, not everybody who works on this stuff does work for companies. Some people are doing it in their free time or as part of these open collective funded efforts the way that Babel has. So one of the things in TC39 was to make sure we had a strong invited expert program to make sure that people who aren't working for particular legal entities can participate when they're playing a core ecosystem role. But it's always better if developers can get paid, I think. I shouldn't say always. It's great to have code projects that people are doing in their free time. But then when they become really critical ecosystem dependencies, when they become really important projects, I think it's better to have people paid to work on them. So then there's a question, where does the money come from? Sometimes it can be a person allocated part of their time within their day job to do things, which is good. At Bloomberg, we found it to be effective to work with other consultants so that they can be full-time on the project. So we paid Igalia as well as other consultancies. This is important because we can really get things done this way. You know, every year we have a contract with particular expectations. I think this is like an understated thing for open source sustainability that can be done. Everybody's working on setting up open collectives, which are great when they can be done. That's a great way to get funding collected from multiple places. But to make that add up to a single developer's salary is really hard. It takes a lot of effort to just collect all the different groups to make donations. It takes a lot of visibility. And some efforts are really important to get done that aren't so visible. So within companies, if the company has resources for it, then they can pay these consultancies such as Igalia to get some work done on these projects. And that's what we found to be pretty effective in Bloomberg. So we've been sponsoring Node.js, we've been sponsoring Chromium, all through this sort of consultancy model. In addition to, we have a program of donating $10,000 per month to different open source projects, mm-hmm. one project per month. And
that's awesome. So 12 projects a year. How do you all come up with that list of 12? Is it your dependencies or?
Well, there's so many dependencies. So it's not like we can just go through them in alphabetical order. We figure out what's the most important projects. So this is a program that Alyssa Wright, who runs our OSPO in Bloomberg.
OSPO is like a like open source office.
Yeah, our open source program mm-hmm. office. So Alyssa Wright was like a co-founder of Open Source Collective and now is at Bloomberg. And so she created this program in partnership with Bloomberg Philanthropies, where we do polls every month or every quarter. I can't remember. We do internal polls of which projects people think are important. There's like a nomination process. And then we, you know, kind of filter out the ones that don't make sense. And then we do a poll among all the engineers at Bloomberg who are interested about which projects should be donated to. So if you want to vote, I don't know, Bloomberg's hiring. And you can go on to our Jamas page.
Yeah, join Bloomberg. Yeah, very indirect way of doing that. But yes, That is certainly an avenue. That's fantastic, Dan. Like, this is a topic I'm really passionate about personally, because, you know, I have so many friends in this community that like work on really critical infrastructure and really critical software and really critical dependencies, libraries, whatever else. And yeah, they definitely don't get the monetary support, as well as I would say just, yeah, even having contributors and maintainers, you know? And so for me, like, I'm interested in kind of putting an open letter out to the world some point next year around like, hey, here's three ways you can get involved. Like, you can just give straight up cash monthly or annually for whatever amount you can afford, you know? And I think there's a really good formula that Sentry's come up with for how they kind of come up with how much they can donate and to who and whatever else. But there's just give money. The other is like give time, you know, have some of your engineers contribute to your dependencies and or just in general open source projects that are good for the ecosystem, like across the board. I don't even think there should be boundaries. Like, you know, like if it's open source and free and it's important, like it's worth contributing engineering time, you know? So that's an indirect way. And then like the third is kind of like a combination of like give money and also like hire people to work on this stuff full time, right? Like you can do both. Like you can just have someone on payroll whose job it is to be a node contributor. And then the kind of return to you is that you now have this in-house expertise that your team can leverage and so forth and so forth. And so there's so many ways that companies can contribute, but I think without having that framework and understanding of how, you know, like I think it's just not top of mind for most people because they're just trying to ship things to their customers, you know? So we just have to kind of make space for this and do advocacy work as a community. But like, this is not impossible. Like this can happen, you know?
Yeah. And I would say conversely, if you're an open source maintainer or developer and want to make this a paid full-time job, I would encourage you to consider looking for clients to sponsor specific pieces of the work involved. And this can be either through making your own, you know, being your own independent contractor, or there are many different consultancies set up that specialize in different areas of open source work. You just look around a little bit. That's what I did when I was working at Egalia. I didn't want to set up my own, like find my own clients and set up
a business and an LLC and like all that jazz. Yeah.
Yeah. There are lots of different specialized consultancies for different piece of open source. So I recommend that, yeah. That model.
I thought it was, for what it's worth, I never got to share this with you, so I'll share it on air with you and thousands of listeners, which is like, I really loved when you did that. I loved your stint and your time at Egalia. Like, I thought it was so cool because you were like, you had like, I don't want to say golden handcuffs, but you know, you had a plushy job at Google for many years on the V8 team. And then you kind of just went and did the like, indie open source hacker thing for a while through Egalia and got to kind of work in this unshackled way. And obviously you weren't just a developer there. I think you had some leadership roles, which was fantastic. But I appreciated seeing that move. Like it's not a move that we get to see. We see a lot of the opposite where people like, you know, companies like Google and Microsoft poach engineers from places like Egalia and Boku or whatever. And so it made me happy to see that, Dan. I just want to say you're just an awesome human being in general. Oh, and I just, you. I'm happy. We're lucky to have you, dude. You're like, you're gold, you know? So.
Yeah. And Egalia is a cooperative. So I got a leadership position in the sense that I became a partner of Egalia, like an equal co-owner of the company, which is what I think when I was there, it was a little over half the company was partners. So
that's awesome.
There's a lot of emphasis on equality there, which is something that I liked.
It's a pretty cool company. Yeah, we should do a show on Egalia at some point. So that'll put that in the queue as well. Like going into now, we now have enough show topics, I think, to get us through to like June next year. So we'll see how much we can get through. But no, Dan, thank you so much for such an insightful and delightful discussion. I mean, obviously, it's very clear that both JavaScript and CSS are moving towards, you know, really good semantics in the core language without tooling. And it's just really great to see all the little gaps in the spec kind of fill in with these good ideas. And it's just humbling to watch this process also kind of come together, you know, just as a consumer of these specs now that I'm not like super involved with the standards process anymore. So just want to say thank you for everything that you do, my friend, and not just to you, but thank you to everyone involved in shaping the web as we know it. It's the best thing we've ever made, everyone. The web is the greatest thing. It is the greatest thing humanity has ever made. Like, I will argue that with, I think so. Hands down. So it is our collective knowledge base. It is how we communicate and collaborate and build and create and share.
But if you had to choose between the web and like bread, which one would you choose?
I mean, honestly, I think with the modern web, I think ChatGPT could help me figure out how to sustain myself without bread. So, you know, I would probably still choose the web.
I really like bread. I don't know. I would choose the bread over the web. That's just
okay. Well, I think we see who the true diehards are today. Anyways, all right, kids. So with that, we'll end it. It's been a really long discussion. There'll be lots of great links in the show notes. Thank you all so much for your time. Another one in the can. Last show of 2023. Holy moly. What a year, y'all. Thank you for listening. We love you all. We'll be back with a really fun New Year's show, so please tune in for that. And we have a really, really, really exciting year planned ahead. Like, y'all are gonna love all the shows. So thank you all. We love you. Cheers. Bye.
Bye.
This is our final JS Party episode of 2023. But don't worry, we'll be back to ring in 2024 on our annual New Year's Party the first week in January. Thanks to each and every one of you for listening along this year. And hey, if you have some downtime right now, take a moment, hop over to Apple Podcasts or Spotify and hit us up with 5 stars. Maybe write a nice review while you're at it. We appreciate that. JS Party is edited by Jason Backens, produced by me, Jared Santo, with Breakmaster Cylinder on beats. If you dig the beats, search for Changelog Beats in your music app of choice for even more beats like these. On behalf of Nick, Amel, Chris, Cable, and the entire JS Party family, have a great time with friends and family this December, and we'll party together again next year.